KQED. Hey there, everyone. From KQED's politics team, I'm Marisa Lagos, and this is Political Breakdown.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. It has been yet another busy week in politics. President Donald Trump gave his first State of the Union address.
And he actually mentioned California, and I believe the great people who live here. It was in the context, of course, of fires and floods and mudslides.
Did he say he loved us? Because he said he loved the people of Texas.
Yeah,
I think I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, it was more positive, I would say, towards the Golden State than I expected. I mean, he mentioned us, like I said. But I'm curious, Scott, like, what was your read of the speech? Because I felt like it was sort of sold by the White House as a more optimistic look at things, but it was still pretty divisive.
Yeah, you know, all these reports that he left behind, the divisive rhetoric, you know, I didn't hear that. And I think if you said, what's your read? If you read the speech, I think you got one impression. If you saw the speech, I mean, all these families and people that he referred to that stood up and got applause. I mean, the basic message was immigrants are coming and they're going to hurt or kill you and your family. I mean, that, so many of the people who stood up had some... There was some element of that message.
I mean, even the people that he highlighted who were immigrants, right, were escaping the North Korean regime, were sort of being harmed by forces outside of America. So, yeah, I think it landed with a definite thud in Democratic circles in California. We saw Democrats basically flee the floor before
I thought Nancy Pelosi was going to break her jaw. She was like, her teeth were clenched. Absolutely.
Yeah, Scott and I were texting during the
those aren't available to anybody who asked for them, I hope.
Right.
But, you know, the tax bill, you know, that really, I think people are here in California are beginning to feel, you know, how that's going to, you know, screw them, basically. Threats to deport the DACA kids, you know, clock is ticking. There's threats to disrupt the legal marijuana industry. So all these things, you know, saying, hey, you did a nice job with the wildfires, that's nice. But there's all this other stuff happening.
And I think as we have had, you know, talked about on this show, the Trump administration has come through when it came to disaster relief and those sorts of things. But that seems to be the only sort of way that they're willing to give California any help. But back here in California, we are looking forward to the June primary. And I think this week we started to get a better sense of, you know, how things are shaping up in some of these top of the ticket races. The governor's race, we saw a campaign finance numbers come in. And Gavin Newsom, who you got to interview today, was head and shoulders above everybody else.
He was. He's got about $19.6 million cash on hand. And that is more than all the others combined. Number two is Villaraigosa. He's got about $6 million. John Chung, $5.8 and change. Delaine Easton, $184,000. John Cox, I think, loaned himself $3 million, and he's got $2 million left. So, you know, money isn't votes, but it certainly helps you talk to voters. So Gavin Newsom, I think, feeling pretty good. I'm sure, like you, I get all these pitches for money from all the campaigns, and let's just say Gavin Newsom sends them out pretty often. It was funny, the one that we got like at around this time yesterday. He's like, the deadline's coming. We're not going to meet our goals. And if we miss our goals, reporters are going to say we've plateaued.
Right, which is like interesting, as you said, because he has raised so much money. He had such a strong year last year. I mean, $10 million in 2017 alone. He's also got, as you mentioned, like $3 million in another account he can spend from. And I think it's important to think about the comparison to 8 years ago when he was trying to challenge Governor Jerry Brown in the primary and just couldn't raise the money.
Yeah, he dropped out, ran for lieutenant governor. And I think, you know, and I talked with him a little bit about this. He has come, I think, to appreciate Jerry Brown. They had a pretty tense relationship in the first years. Gavin Newsom, you know, some veiled or not so veiled criticism of the governor at one point, a year or two in. I don't think he'd ever had a meeting with the governor. And I think that's warmed up a bit. And I think he probably, either because he has to or because he truly does, has grown to appreciate, you know, Jerry Brown you know, what kind of politician he is.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. One thing that's been really telling to me in recent months is how much people around the governor seem to have embraced Gavin Newsom, just in their rhetoric when they talk about him both privately and publicly. And I think that that is a change because there was a lot of tension there. I think we should quickly note also this other big race, although will it be a big race? race, the U.S. Senate race.
Yeah,
yeah, Dianne Feinstein, speaking of people loaning themselves money. But she's got almost $10 million in the bank. About $5 million of that is her own money.
27 or so times more than Kevin DeLeon, who had the misfortune of announcing he was running, and then suddenly it became the year of the woman.
Right. And also, you know, I think this was going to be a challenge for him either way. She is one of the most well-known politicians in California. And he had a bunch of money socked away in a campaign account he cannot touch because it's for state campaigns and this is a national campaign. And
Lieutenant Governor, I think, wasn't it? Is that the one?
I believe so, yeah. So he's got less than 500 grand in the bank to her nearly 10 million. So expect some of those emails from Kevin DeLeon, I suppose, if you're on his list.
And it's, you know, of course, when you get that far behind, it's tougher to raise the money. You know, who's going to put, you know, you get the low-hanging fruit, you know, in the first weeks and months of the campaign. And then after that, you know, you gotta make them, convince them you've got a shot at winning.
Yeah, I mean, money talks in California in a state this big. Well, I think we want to move on to our next guest because she is quite a powerhouse. We're going to be talking to Gail Kaufman, political consultant out of Sacramento, in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. And we're back, joined now by veteran political consultant Gail Kaufman.
Now, if you're a Sacramento insider, you know exactly who Gail Kaufman is. But in case you don't, we got you covered here. Gail has been a force, a gale force, I guess you could say, in California politics for more than 30 years. And if there's a ballot measure that affects teachers, say, or labor unions, well, there's a pretty good chance that Gail helped get it passed or killed at the ballot box, depending on which side those folks happen to be on.
Yeah, she is known as a rare, powerful woman in a world that is often dominated by dudes. And she brought even the Terminator to his knees. I think we're going to get into that a little bit. But if you're one of the millions of Californians who enjoy legal marijuana, you can also thank her for that.
Thanks, Gail. Gail, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's talk about pot.
I mean, why not?
Yeah, you know.
Sure.
You were involved in that from soup to nuts, I guess. You know, Prop 64, which legalized marijuana in California. Talk about that process, because I know that consultants sometimes get involved sort of after the thing has qualified. You were involved from the very beginning on this, and talk about how it came about and what that was like, that process.
Sure. This was the only initiative I can think of that I actually was involved from all the way through the writing of it. So all, if you like the provisions and you don't like them, I was involved in all the decision making from the beginning to the end, for the good and the bad of that. And like any initiative that's trying to do something completely new, it really was complicated. There were many people who thought they had a really good idea of how to do this. And if you remember, why would you? Because there were so many initiatives on the ballot with it. It was very long. We asked voters whether they wanted us to make it short or whether they wanted to really see all of it.
So I can't remember now, but
it was a long initiative.
You say asked voters, you mean you had like a focus group or what?
Yeah, we did focus groups and said, did you want to see just this legalizes weed, or do you want to see all the things that are in it so that you can read it for yourself? And they said they wanted to see it. So that's how we did it.
And that was pretty different than the one that had failed a few years before. But I imagine that also makes it challenging to get all the sort of various interest groups who were backing legalization on board. I mean, was that a challenge? Because I know that this is not, I mean, you know, in California, we have had medical marijuana for a while, but I do think it's still a pretty new industry, and they're probably not all as politically savvy as some of the groups you're used to dealing with.
No, and you're absolutely right. So the people that were really invested in it and who were activists on the issue and had worked on the one before, which I had not, certainly all had a point of view going in, and they might have been interested in it for the social justice aspects. They might have been, you know, cultivators, whatever the issue was, and there were many. They all had points of view. So that was one of the more complicated parts of it, and it took us a long time. And then in the middle of all of it, probably more detail than you need, but we were right in the middle of writing this initiative when the legislature passed new regulations on medical marijuana. And we had intended to do things very different than we ended up, because we wanted to make them closer to each other. So that meant redrafting and going back to the drawing board. So it was a complicated process.
Yeah.
It was fascinating to me, though, because in the end, we did get a pretty broad coalition. We didn't ever satisfy everyone. But I think that's, you know, part of the process of negotiation and also, you know, just figuring out what voters will accept as well. And that was holding a hard line on some of the, you know, protections for children, some of the law enforcement issues. It was complicated.
What did you learn from, say, what happened in Colorado? They passed it there, I think, Washington State. And then, as Marisa said, there was a failed effort here in California before that. What were the lessons?
Well, first of all, we did see, you know, through the whole campaign, we were hoping, and it actually happened, that there were no really bad things that were going on in any of the states where it was already legal, because that's always tricky. What we learned was, and talked to a lot of the people from the different states on how they went about, you know, some of the very simple things. I know this sounds crazy, but I was fixated on the fact that we would pass it, it would go into law. But where would it be? You couldn't just immediately say, well, we've done this, so I can go buy marijuana here. And in fact, you know, January 1st of this year was the date that actually can happen. But it's going to still be a while before everyone in every area where there are stores and retail opportunities where they can get up and running. So it's a longer process than I think you originally would think about. And those kinds of things drove me crazy.
Well,
trying to figure them out.
I want to talk about somebody else who drove you crazy, which is former Governor Arnold
Schwarzenegger.
Yes, Arnold Schwarzenegger. One of the things I think you are very well known for in Sacramento circles is the 2005 special election that the governor called for a bunch of ballot measures that really tried to attack organized labor. The California Teachers Association is one of your biggest clients. Talk to me about that special election and, like, why did you think you could win against the governor?
Well, you know, you always think we didn't know if we could win. We were hoping that if we put the different issues together, which we did, and we put a strong enough coalition together, that was the time we did teachers, nurses, firefighters as our mantra. We did an awful lot of organizing. We had huge rallies. We really had to do a very grassroots effort, but we didn't know until we got into the middle of it whether you could run four campaigns simultaneously all know, and whether that would work. It had been, I don't know when the last time something like that happened. But we did feel like he had gone too far with many of the things. He was very popular when we started. So that was the tricky part, was could we take his popularity and keep it where it was, or try and not deal with that as much as that he was just wrong on these different issues.
And as I remember,
No, I was just going to say, and we had to do that. And we were thankfully successful.
And I remember that I think the nurses in particular kind of dogged him. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. They spent an awful lot of time following him around, which was not really our strategy.
They just did that on their own? Was that a problem?
That was their strategy. No. I mean, we won. So
it's all whatever happened worked.
The bottom line.
If you won.
What I seem to remember reading, you had a conversation with Mike Murphy, who was the GOP consultant working for the governor. And you basically told him, look, we're going to kick some tail here.
Step off.
So, look, here's your chance to, you know. So is that like a poker face kind of thing? You go in and say, look, you say you have a stronger hand than maybe you really think you do. See if he blinks.
Oh, no. We really knew we had. No, I'm kidding. Yes. I went in. I knew that he didn't understand California initiatives as well as I did. So that I did have going for me. I also knew that he had a very popular governor that he was working with. But I did have to go in and just say, and what I said I honestly believed, which was that he didn't understand when you mobilize people the way that we could mobilize around these issues, that he couldn't compete on that level. So all the money in the world would never be the same as when you get not only members of labor, but people who really care about the kinds of issues we were talking about, taking on the teachers, taking on nurses and firefighters and people that take care of you, and that we would be able to do that kind of populist campaign. And you can tell that to somebody, but until they see it start to happen, they don't believe you.
So, Gail, I know
and
that
he didn't.
He did not. And afterward, I think he still continued to disparage you. So I don't know.
I think he's
a little bitter. Yeah.
So this year, I mean, as a governor's race, as a U.S. Senate race, we're going to have ballot initiatives. It's sort of the calm before the storm, I assume, for people like you, if there ever is. I mean, tell me what you're looking forward to this year and what you think people should be really watching.
Well, obviously, the governor's race is a big thing. I think what we're all looking at from the consulting side is what's going to happen in June, to be honest. Not what the races are, because for someone like me, I really know that, like, the off-year elections really are off-year, and that there hasn't been enough excitement yet around the governor's race. That if you asked 10 people, stopped them on the street, and asked them if they knew what election was coming up, I'd be amazed if more than one of them would tell you that there was a governor's race happening in June. But I think by June, that will certainly change, especially given some of the money you were talking about. So what's really fascinating and interesting to me is who's going to show up. There's so many. I had one reporter call me last week and say, I understand there's going to be an inordinately high Latino turnout in June. And you know, we hear that a lot.
I feel like we've been hearing that for years.
Exactly. And my answer was, well, that could happen, but there's no evidence of that yet. And so, you know, the Women's March that just happened in January was the first indication to me that maybe there really was going to be something different happening this year. And that maybe all the activism you've seen and the anger at Trump and some of those things would take the form of higher turnout in a primary that is normally not a high turnout election. We were just looking yesterday, and there was, I think, 4 million people who showed up in 2014 for the governor's primary. And that's not a big turnout. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that may not fascinate other people, but they really will interest me in terms of what is all this Trump stuff meant to voters? Are they going to come out?
Do you think that if there is some kind of a deal on DACA and, you know, immigration more broadly, do you think that could tamp down some of the turnout for Latino voters?
Oh, no. I don't think so. I think if anything, I certainly hope that the DACA stuff happens and that there is a deal, as you just discussed. And I think that would be wonderful. And I think people would then even be more excited about the fact that there's a lot of Latino names on the ballot. There's lots of reasons for people to come out. But and to show their support for, you know, what California has done as opposed to the rest of the country, and certainly the president on this issue. So I don't know that that would tamp down turnout. I think if nothing happens, that would certainly, you know, I don't think you have to guess what that would mean. But I think by and large, Latinos have been really upset and hurt by what is being the rancor and the descriptions of their communities and just everything that Trump has done. So I think the damage has been done for anyone who has, you know, a Latino background at all. And I think for a lot of us who have, you know, been progressive activists or been in the business for as long as I have, you know, this is very upsetting. And not always does that kind of emotion turn out into voting, and I'm hopeful that it will this time. But I'm also not ready to say that it will.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Gail, because one thing we've been talking about, I think, since the Trump election is really this issue of the fact that, you know, is this sort of the national 187 moment? And by that, I mean Prop 187, which was what Governor Pete Wilson ran in the 90s and really, you know, did, I think, change the calculation in California for a lot of people. Although, as we've just discussed, it hasn't always gone meant a lot of turnout. We're talking right now with political strategist Gail Kaufman. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for information about how to support KQED, you can visit kqed.org. You're listening to Political Breakdown on KQED Public Radio.
And we continue our conversation with Gail Kaufman. Gail, you've been doing this for over 30 years, and I'm wondering, does people get so cynical about politics? Has all the work you've done made you more or less cynical about politics?
I have to say more. But I also feel that I've been a part of a process that I feel very strongly about. And that, unfortunately, as progressive as I may feel personally, means I'm part of the establishment. And so, you know, I kind of go back and forth. We have great victories. I think, you know, you watch just this governor has done some things, you know, with the economy and trying to really be terrific on climate change, just some of those things. Those are reasons to be optimistic that being a Democrat and being in government and trying to fix it. You know, I, for many, many years, I don't do it anymore, but I was involved in electing a lot of Democrats in the state of California. So, yeah, I'm cynical, but I also believe in the process, and I see no process better than the one that we have.
You know, I want to ask you about those earlier years when you were working to get legislators, Democrats elected in Sacramento. You worked under Willie Brown, you and others like Richie Ross. What did you learn from Willie Brown?
Oh, boy, we don't have enough time. But the best thing. And he really was a mentor for me in this regard, as I was fortunate enough to be able to sit in the room and watch him negotiate. And so what I call the inside game of politics, really being able to sit in a room with people and read them, like the meeting with Mike Murphy, I learned how to do things like that from Willie Brown.
Like what? And can you give an example?
I'll never be as good as him, but, well, I mean, he
the poker
could sit
face.
In a room and... The poker face, and he was known for, everybody walked out of the room thinking their point of view was the point of view that ruled the day. And that was a strength that, you know, he was able to use for many, many things. And so I learned virtually everything I know about substantive politics as well as how to help negotiate things from him. And I still call him all the time and ask his advice.
Well, we know in San Francisco he's still very active and engaged in politics.
Does he charge you for the advice, Gail?
Yeah. No, it's kind of a reciprocal thing. Occasionally, you know, I help him.
So I mentioned earlier, you know, that your connections to CTA and organized labor, obviously under this president, you know, labor is really under attack. I know there's a Supreme Court decision that could really cut into their ability to fund political campaigns. And I think there's also sort of a feeling in some circles of America that, you know, unions aren't as necessary as they used to be. What's your read on all of that? And in California, do you expect them to continue being the players that they have been over the last couple decades?
Well, I certainly think so, because especially under Trump, I think unions are more important than they ever have been because people have no other protections. Look what he does and look how quixotic he is. And you can't figure out from day to day what he's going to do and who he's going to do it to. So, you know, any group that has some level of protection, whether it's for their health care, whether it's for just their work benefits and being able to, you know, negotiate contracts, I mean, that's where unions have their strength. So I'm hopeful that they are. I, you know, obviously we look at this Supreme Court and we know what may happen. And that is something that I think, you know, the right wing for many, many, I've run three campaigns on the issue of union dues in the state of California. It was my first initiative and I've, you know, we've done three. So the right has tried to take this issue on and they very well may succeed this time and say that you don't have to pay to be a part of a union and you can still get, if there is a union where you work, you can still get some of the services without paying. And that would be unfortunate.
We started off saying that you are one of the rare women in that world of political consulting. And, you know, who was it? Somebody used to say that, I think Obama said it, but others used to say that, you know, Ginger Rogers did what Fred Astaire did, but she did it backwards and in heels. Did you feel like, especially in the earlier years, but even now, did you have particular obstacles? Did you have to work harder? Did you have to be better than the guys who were doing what you did?
Yeah, I think so. I think that probably the biggest thing for me is there just weren't very many people that I could look at and say I could follow that path. They're just, when I started running campaigns, there really weren't very many women in the business, either here in California or anywhere. So, you know, my role models were men and not women. So I've tried to help where I can to mentor women and encourage more people to get in the business. Thank goodness there are a ton more than there were when I started. But yeah, it's hard. And, you know, I've heard my reputation. I've heard what people say about me. I'm very, you know, the word tough comes out a lot. Words that I don't think would be used
for men.
For men.
Yeah.
Are usually the words that describe me, and I now wear them as a badge of honor after all this time.
Good
and
for you, Gail.
I've just figured out how to do it and sit in the room and, you know, and get things done. But yeah, there were moments.
I mean, we only have a few more minutes, but I'm curious if you feel like the fact that you have been kind of on your own as a consultant for so long has helped, you know, sort of meet some of those challenges, because you haven't had, you know, to be in an organization where it's all dominated by men, even if the broader political world is.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that was a decision I made early, that I wanted to try and see if I could do this on my own. Not everyone, I must say, was encouraging of that or thought that I would succeed, but most, but I was, and I did. You know, I had to win campaigns in order to be successful. And I don't know that I could have done that unless I did it my way and, you know, just had to figure it out. And that's what I love about campaigns, is no two of them are the same. So, you know, that was kind of the way I did it.
In the last few seconds, if a woman, a young woman came to you and said, you know, I'm thinking maybe I'd like to go into your line of work, what would you tell them? Would you encourage them to do it or not?
Absolutely. I do all the time. I can't imagine anything more interesting, more exciting. What I love is that, as I said, no two campaigns are the same. Every day is different. There are many challenges, but there are huge positives if you believe in what you're doing. And I always have. I've always taken issues that I cared about or felt, you know, strongly about. And so if that's the – and candidates too. So if that's the reason you get into it, I encourage everyone. And I encourage them to go be in a campaign to start with.
And run for office.
Figure it out like we all had to, you know, kind of from the bottom up.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you're going to do this year, Gail, and in the future. I think, like we said, this will be a fun year for politics and maybe not always for political consultants, but we really appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Sure, this was great.
Well, that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. You can find it on Apple Podcasts.
You can also find it on NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts, really. Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor, and Holly Kernan is the vice president of news.
I'm Marisa Lagos. You can follow me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's @ScottSchaefer.
That is it for this week's Political Breakdown on KQED. We'll see you next time.
See ya.